Hi, this is Jonathan Liu, senior editor of Geek Dad, and this is not our regular Geek Dad podcast. It's a side project I'm calling Talking About Stuff, because all the good titles have already been taken. I'm hoping to do interviews with cool people, talk about books, board games, and other things that I don't always have time to review in more detail on the site. So thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Liu for Geek Dad, and today I'm talking with Tony Dieterlizzi. He's got a new book out, The Battle for Wunla, and he's getting ready to go on tour. And so I'm really excited about this book. It's one of the things I've been waiting for this year, and it's finally out. So, Tony, how are you?
I'm good. That was a lovely introduction. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You and me, we're the two people waiting for this book to come out.
Well, I've got my family is excited. They saw the package arrive, and my wife actually was home when it came, and I was out of town, and she said, "I saw what was on the address label, and I didn't open it," because if she did, I think she would have been done with it by the time I got home.
She's like, "So instead I've used it to hold the door open, and it's a big book. Perfect for that."
Yeah, no, we're excited because I've read the first two out loud to my kids. So now we get to see how the story ends.
That's so awesome, Jonathan. I mean, you and I've talked about this before. It's like my favorite time of day with my daughter, Sophia. We always, you know, sit in bed and read together. And even though she can read her own books now, she still wants me to read to her. And I hope that I will ride that train as long as she lets me. And I always think about that with the Wunla books, that's totally what I was thinking of when I was writing all three of them.
Yeah, my kids are now 10 and 7, and I'm still reading to them in the evenings, although it gets busier. You know, they now have a little bit of quiet reading time to themselves at bedtime.
Right.
But, you know, we still love reading books out loud to them. And actually, Wunla was one of the first ones where I was reading the same book to both of them.
Oh, nice.
So,
wow.
Yeah, it was, I think, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and I forget what the other one was. And then we started on the Wunla series. And so now, you know, it's been fun being able to have that, you know, shared experience as opposed to when they were younger. Yeah, I'd read one to the older girl, one to the younger girl, and, you know.
Yeah. I still have memories of, you know, my mom read to us kids, the oldest of three, and she read to us growing up. And I remember that carried into even, like, high school. My mom and I would read a lot of the same types of books. She likes fantasy. And in the 80s, that's all I read was, obviously, Tolkien, and then I read, like, Piers Anthony and Anne McCaffrey and, you know, Elric and stuff like that. And we would always then talk about the books after, you know.
Yeah.
Did you read it? What'd you think? What do you think this is about? And I hope that that's what happens and how it evolves with both your girls and as well with me.
Yeah. So what other books do you read with Sophia?
We just finished the last Ramona book. So we've gone through every single Beverly Cleary Ramona book. And it was great. I mean, she really enjoyed them. I read a couple of them maybe when I was a kid. I mean, I remember them vaguely. I mean, I remember the characters and I remember some of the things that happened. And, she loved them. And so we've been tearing through all of them. In fact, we were just talking about what we're going to dive into next. We may start the Little House books next. She's six. So, There's certain books that she can read on her own and likes to read. And so chapter book wise, we're still kind of the younger chapter books that we're kind of enjoying. What's interesting to me is the stuff that I loved as a kid that she's not as into. So like, for instance, I tried to read her Winnie the Pooh because I loved Winnie the Pooh and House of Pooh Corner. And when we were very young, and she wasn't buying any of it. She wasn't into it. I was a little bummed out about that. We did get through Mouse and the Motorcycle, which was another favorite of mine. And she liked that one. But I don't know if she was just being nice to me or not.
Yeah. My kids are they're pretty adventurous in what they like. But what I found is, yeah, the ones they really enjoy are things that are just silly. You know, lots of humor in them. So like the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang books, the new ones are really great. And we've been reading The Last Dragon Slayer series by Jasper Ford.
Oh, wow. How is that?
It's it's really good. But a lot of the humor, I'm sure, is just going completely over their heads. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's his first book that's sort of, it's meant for younger readers.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, there's a lot of British humor in there that I think they're not really getting. And a lot of the, right. the puns and things are a little, you know, a little sophisticated. But it's a fun story.
Oh, cool. Very cool. Yeah. There's always that, that element. In fact, we've been talking about Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. I mean, I read it to her when she was really young, and I think she just kind of sat through it. And so now I'm kind of like, we should read it again now that you kind of, you know, you like the film.
Yeah.
So, you know, we should read the original book. And it's such a short read anyway. I mean, we could probably read it in a couple nights. Sometimes that humor or from something from another time period, sometimes it transcends with a kid and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. Back to the Wunla series. How does it feel to have this third book wrapped up?
A bit surreal. They've taken me. I mean, obviously, I started them in 2009, and they'd been in my head for years before that. I feel like a great accomplishment that I was even able to see it through. You know, with Spiderwick, it was with Holly, so there was always someone to kind of spur the other person on and keep going.
Yeah.
When you get tired or your deadline was looming or, you know, you get distracted. And with these books, it was just me. And that was a good thing and a bad thing. And, you know, the good thing is you can come to the end of it and go, what, you know, I did this. I made this whole story that I had in my head and I got it down on paper. And then the bad thing is you have to do it all the writing and all the right. illustrating on your own. So, you know, I mean, I really intensely focused on this third book. For all of last year, that's all I did mm-hmm. was work on this one book. It's interesting when you get to the third book, you know the characters well enough. When I outlined the trilogy as a whole, I already knew kind of what the big general beats of the plot were going to be, and I knew that they would probably change and evolve as the story started to come into focus. But the good thing about it is, you know the characters well enough by the third book that you kind of know, like, well, this is what Eva would do mm-hmm. in this situation, or this is what she would say, you know, and this is what Haley would do, and this is what Rovender would do. And so that kind of stuff helps an awful lot. It makes it a lot easier to do. I think the trick is how do I raise it and deliver what I'd hope would be a very, for me, grand and satisfying conclusion. Yeah. That's where you get nervous and the jitters, and you hope that you can really provide, you know, all the people who have read the, you know, really honestly over 1,000 pages before this, you know, that they feel like when they're done, they felt like, okay, that was worth the read. That was a good read. I really enjoyed it.
I'm in chapter 8 so far, so I'll let you know.
So if the interview never airs, I'll know what you felt. Yeah.
When you're right, I know you had your major beats planned out. Did you ever find that you had more things that you wanted to write than you had room for? I mean, did the book get any bigger than you had planned?
Yeah, the first one was the longer book, and then the second book was a little shorter, much to my surprise. I actually thought it would have been the other way around. I would have thought the middle book would have been the longer. And I thought that this book was going to be closer in length to the second book. But it, in fact, ended up being a bit longer and closer in length to the first book. So, gosh, I don't know what that puts it. It's got to be 500 pages, maybe? Yeah, it's got to be close to 500 pages, I think.
Yeah.
Like the first book. You know, with all the art and stuff like that. And I think that part of the reason of that was the ending. I don't like a happily ever after the ending to a story. I want there to be ripples. Mm-hmm. You know, I want there to be a little bit of beyond it a little bit. It helps with this book because of the theme of this book and the theme being the things we do in our life, the people we touch in our life, the actions that we take. We don't always see the repercussions or the conclusion or the response immediately. Sometimes it takes time. And it's definitely a theme in this book. It's talked about in this book. And so I realized I had to do something along those lines. And I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, Ari Burke. He's an author. He's written a lot of great books on his own. And he's also worked with Brian Froud on some of Brian's books. And Ari was the one who suggested, you know, why don't you really push that idea, like, even like go further and further out with it. Like, after Eva's story is over, how does Eva's story ripple through time? Mm. And it was such a fascinating idea, and I took it and ran with it. And so that added a little bit more to the end of the book. But I think it'll again give you that feeling, at least that, like, it's like, man, that was such a great meal. That was so delicious. And the dessert was really good. I feel like I need like a little espresso afterwards or something. You know what I mean? Like, you want that one little thing, like, yeah, just a little bit more. So I'm hoping that this delivers that. That was a big, big part of, and it also extended the story, made it a little longer than I had originally anticipated.
And you'd mentioned, you know, possibly doing like what you did with the Spiderwick field guide, you know, and ending up doing some sort of Orbona field guide or travelogue type book.
We set out, that was definitely the idea, where I thought, you know, we could do that. When I first signed the books up, we talked about doing the three books and then do kind of this art of book. The interesting thing that happened was we ended up doing these little sketchbooks, yeah, that kind of go along with it. And between the sketchbooks and then the sheer amount of art that I had to do within the books, I kind of felt like I don't know if it needs a big field guide, mm-hmm, because I felt like the sketchbooks are fairly exhaustive. And then we have all the art in the book. So I think what we may do, and I could get in trouble for saying this, but I think when they all go into paperback, I think we'll probably put all the sketchbooks into one finished book and release it that way. I think that's what we'll end up doing.
I'd love to see, you know, I think the sketchbooks be more widely available, because those were more like promo items, right? And they're not something you can go to the store and buy.
Not something you go to the store and buy. I wanted to do something special for the people who I got to meet, the people that would come out to a book signing. Yeah. You know, Ange and I had we'd been going to Comic-Con for years. And that's like one of my favorite things to purchase in the sea of stuff to buy at Comic-Con are these artists will make these little limited edition sketchbooks that you can only get, yeah, you know, from them. I love that feeling, because I think for me, like, I started out doing stuff like that back in my Dungeons and Dragons days, and I love that I'm with a huge publisher and that they support my books. But you do sometimes long for that, like, kind of handcrafted old, mm-hmm, you know, just grassroots kind of thing. Like, I got this thing, and the only way to get it was, you know, you had to meet them. And so that was kind of the idea behind doing those little limited edition sketchbooks. But I think, you know, once they're done, you know, I don't want them to not be available. So I think that's the plan. You know, you could talk to me a year from now and the plan could change, but the idea is that we'll eventually put them all together into one supplemental book.
Okay. Since you brought up Dungeons and Dragons days, I figured that's actually a good topic for Geek Dad.
Let's go. Let me get my dice.
So I am actually, you know, a role-playing newbie. I have not played a lot of role-playing games, but
I'm sorry, we're breaking up. I think I got to go now, dude. You call yourself a geek.
I know. Well, you know what? I grew up in a pretty conservative family, and so at the time, Dungeons and Dragons was not allowed. So I made up my own, you know, little role-playing games that I played with friends, but I had no idea of how, like, D&D actually worked. So I just made things up, right? Okay. But a lot of our writers, you know, have been playing D&D since the beginning. And so I wanted to know, you know, what did you do and how'd you get involved?
I played, you know, second edition in the 80s when it first came out. I was in middle school and, you know, like the rest of the country, you know, like most kids, I was playing it. In fact, I think my parents bought it to play with some of their friends, and that lasted like a night or two, and then they were done with it. They were over it. So we ended up, I think when they realized what a time suck it is, they were kind of like, all right, I'm going to give it to the kids, and we loved it. So we played. And, you know, then I lost interest, like, you know, moved on to the next thing, and I forgot about it. I kept all my D&D books as I got older, but I still would look at them and loved it, but I mostly forgot about it as I finished, you know, high school and stuff. And when I was almost done, I was just about ready to graduate art school. And I went to art school down in Fort Lauderdale at the Art Institute. And I had moved back in with my parents, 'cause that's what you do when you're, you know, poor art student. And I, some of my friends were, they were kind of finishing up school and kind of coming back. And there was a group of us hanging out at the bar one night, and we were kind of talking about D&D, and we started kind of reminiscing about all, you know, how much we loved it when we were kids. And we're like, well, let's play again. Let's do it next Saturday. You know, let's all do it. And, you know, one person had one book, one person had another book. And between the group of us, we had, you know, everything we needed. So we started playing, and everybody was like, oh, you got to draw my character and stuff. And I was, it was great. It was fun. And I remember, like, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And one of the things that was also interesting was I always played with the little lead miniatures. That was, like, one of my favorite parts of D&D was, you know, you made your character, then you went to the toy store, the hobby store, you bought a little lead miniature that kind of looked like your character, you took it home and you painted it, and or if you were the dungeon master, you'd, you know, buy the goblins or the lizard men or whatever you were going to use. I loved all that part of it. I liked it because it was like a way to play with toys, but you weren't really playing with toys. They were like more like game pieces, but really you were still like using toys to tell a story. Yeah. I loved that component of tabletop games. So my younger brother, who's 9 years younger than me, hadn't experienced Dungeons and Dragons, and also he was playing with us, and he was kind of fascinated by these little lead miniatures. So we went and got these miniatures, and I showed him, like, oh, you get them and you paint them and all this stuff. And so then we started drawing the miniatures and everything like that. And then at the encouragement of my gaming buddies and my brother, I sent a bunch of stuff to TSR. They were still there. They were still in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And they were still publishing the game. This would have been like the early 1990s. And after a few failed attempts to try to get in, I got in, and they started hiring me. And I worked with them through most of the 90s. I worked on the first ever colored edition of the Monster Manual. And then I worked with some original game designers like Zeb Cook. I was the illustrator for a series of a campaign setting and a series of adventures for the Planescape line, which was kind of a crossroads or a confluence of all the mythologies and D&D realms, then you could kind of plane hop to different realms. And it was a great time in my life. I have no bad memories of working, except for the deadlines were always really pretty tight. It was such a great time. The people were so amazing, and it was, and I learned a lot. I really, really learned a lot as a storyteller. I feel that a lot of things in life kind of happen to you for a reason, and I think it was important that I worked for those guys before I started making kids' books. Mm-hmm. I really do, because I learned how to do world building. I learned it wasn't just about the character. It was about the costume and the artifacts and the other characters, and then the creatures and monsters and the environment and the architecture, and all that stuff is all integral to each other, to one another. I think about all those sorts of things when I work on, you know, and create a book. I helped with Spiderwick, and it certainly was absolutely integral for Wanda. I used a lot of the same skills that I used illustrating Planescape to design the world of Orbana.
Yeah. Have you played any role-playing games with Sophia?
We have. We've played, we started up this winter a new campaign, and we're just playing second edition because, again, it's the books everybody has. And I'm running it. I'm the dungeon master. And we've had a couple sessions. The trick now that's harder is, you know, everybody's so busy, so it's hard to get, you know, everybody together in one room. But she absolutely loved it. And the way we kind of did it, because the adults are like, you know, I'm good from, you know, 5 o'clock to about midnight or one. And everybody's kind of done. Obviously, we're not going to keep our six-year-old up that late. So we made her a pixie. She's either a pixie or a sprite. I don't recall. I have to go back and look at her character. We looked at the stats in the monster manual. So that allows her to kind of come and go in the adventure. And Angela, my wife, is this dwarf fighter who's just amazing, arrogant, totally in it for himself, not a team player, but he's a good friend. He's got this little pixie that's kind of that he grew up with. And so they're kind of buddies. So we've had already some really great adventures, and she's a great, she totally gets it. She's really great. So it's been a lot of fun. And the thing that's, as a complete tangent sideline, I have a lot of lead miniatures. I don't have as many as I used to when I worked for TSR. But one of the things we thought would be kind of fun was I had written this article about the plastic toys that had inspired a lot of the Dungeons & Dragons monsters. And I had a lot of them, and I thought, what if we just played using these plastic toys? Because after all, that's what the original guys were using when they, when, you know, Gary Gygax and Tim Kask and all, and Dave Arneson and stuff, when they were first creating the game. So I had been on a quest of buying just little plastic figures and you know, characters and rubber monsters. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, it probably cost me about $200 or $300 off of eBay buying all these little lots of cheap toys. But if that was lead miniatures, it would have been like $1,000. Right. You know what I mean? So I have this crazy, like, tackle box filled with, you know, How to Train Your Dragon plastic figures and, you know, bad Hong Kong monsters. But everybody loves it. Everybody's really into it. Everyone felt like it added a lot of fun back into the game. And I think too, they can take the wear and tear of a bunch of people playing a game. And you're always, the thing when I was a kid was like, you paint these lead miniatures and then, you know, the DM would go, okay, that guy's dead. He'd tip him over and slide him off the game board. And you could see the paint just smear the game table. And you're like, no, it took hours. And with these guys, they can take the hit. You can throw them across the room. They're fine.
Nice. So when does the Wunla RPG set come out?
Oh, man, don't I wish. But there's a lot of similarities. I mean, if you know your classic D&D monsters, there's a lot of similarities in the, I mean, the Ankheg and the Sand Snipers are very similar creatures, the kind of burrowing crustacean monster. I know Otto is like a water bear and a tardigrade, but his lines to me are very much like an owl bear. Mm-hmm. You know, he's very big and kind of burly. He's got the claws and the little beak like an owl bear would have. So it's there. It's all there. It's still in my DNA. It's still, you know, it's still going to come out. All my years of working on Planescape and stuff, it's part of who I am, and it's part of me that I really love and sometimes miss.
Yeah. I bet if you just tweet or post on your blog that someone should make a Wunla RPG, that someone will do it for you.
someone tweeted me recently and said they had run, I think, Numenera, and they had to do a Wunla adventure, and I was very tickled by that. I thought that was really awesome. You know, who knows? Maybe down the road, we'll see. I've come to this, and it's a kind of an interesting thing for me, especially coming out of something like Spiderwick. You come to the realization, I think a lot of times in the industry I can't speak for adult publishing, but children's publishing, you think of these things almost like a movie, and you put a lot of pressure on them to open big. Uh-huh. You know, like, the book came out. Did it get on the Times list? Did it make any other bestseller list? Did it do this? Did it do that? And certainly those things are gratifying, and they're important to the sales force and stuff like that to sell a book. But unlike a film that requires maybe, you know, 90 to 120 minutes of our time to consume, these books take a really long time mm-hmm. to read. And that's, you know, and if you're 10 years old, all the more longer. So I felt, now I've kind of come to that where it's like, Wunla could, it's always done well, and I've gotten great, beautiful letters from fans and people. But it could be the type of thing, like you're saying, like a role-playing game. It could be like 3 or 4 years from now where someone's like, I finally read all three of them, and
right,
there should be the game. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and that's the one thing with it takes even longer reading them out loud. And there are so many books I want to share with my kids. And it's like, but, you know, I got to finish this one first. And, yeah. And my, you know, my 10-year-old, she reads constantly, and she reads fast. And so, you know, I feel bad sometimes where I got a book and I know we're all waiting for that. We've been waiting for this, you know, the book two, book three. And she'll say, can I just go read that? I'm like, no. I want to read that one to you. You know, but at some point I end up saying, well, you know, it's going to be a while before I get to that with you. So, you know, so go ahead.
Just go.
But she can't have Wunla yet. She's got to wait.
She hits it like the next day. She's like, done.
I know. You know, but I like the idea of that. You know, the first time we read this, we're going to read this together and really savor it, get to experience it together for the first time. I think I really love doing that.
That means a lot to me. That's really awesome. I mean, and that's, like I said, that's something I thought about while I was writing these books and putting them together. You know, the idea of an adult, and it doesn't even have to be a parent. It could be a librarian or a teacher, or, you know, just a favorite adult in someone's life sharing that. 'Cause I feel like Wunla works on multiple levels. At least that was my goal. Mm-hmm. You know, it asks a lot of philosophical questions. So they're questions we're aware of when we're children, and we start to realize and think about. But they're questions that remain with us even when we're adults.
Do you feel like the books get? Do you feel like the three stories are for progressively older readers or more mature readers, like emotionally and you know, philosophically?
That's a great question. I think I definitely planned in Eva's arc to have her see the world very black and white in the first yeah. book, a little more tinge of grays in the second book, and then by the time she got to the third book, she kind of realizes that everyone's kind of operating on their own set of morals, and it's up to her to find out what set of rules in life guide her that just sit well with her, despite what other people may say. I guess you could say that that is aging it up as you go from book to book, but it is a coming-of-age book. Mm-hmm. This is kind of really where Eva really, really grows. This is where she kind of starts to understand that concept. Mm-hmm. And it's a tough concept to learn because... at least for me, when you're a child and you're young, you view all adults as right. You think everyone is good, and you think everyone is looking out for children, or you know, or they would never do anything that would be harmful in any way. As Eva learned right from the get go, that's not always the case. And then I think she starts to understand, you know, Bastille the huntsman in the first book he's a bad guy, right? And then in the second book, she finds her sister, but then her sister is not quite exactly what she thought. And then by the time she gets to the third book, she starts to rethink things about a lot of the characters that she's met previously. Mm-hmm. Really, almost every character returns in some form in the third book. There's only like one or two new characters, but I really felt like the stage was set, and now Eva, with this kind of a little more of an understanding of the world now, is kind of go back to some of these places, but she's a little more enlightened mm-hmm. now based on the experiences that she's had.
Is there significance to the color choices? So I noticed like the first one has the green, the illustrations have the green tint, and the second one has blue. I felt like, well, the first one really was set kind of in the, you know, a lot of the nature scenes, and then this last one has kind of the orangey red color.
The second color printing, yeah, I definitely, that was inspired by The Wizard of Oz, which uses a two-color printing process, actually throughout the book. They kind of change it from chapter to chapter or section to section. And so we decided to do it, but on just the Wandla books, each book would get its own kind of thematic color. And I knew green was one. And I knew this other kind of, I don't even know, it's like a honey, peachy... Mm-hmm. It does a lot of neat things. It was a designer friend that I've worked with named John Lind who said, you're not going to believe this, but if you go with like a kind of an orangey peach, it works amazing in two color. And I'm like, really? He's like, I know it doesn't sound like it, but when you overlay the black tones and gray tones on top of it, you're going to get like some amazing mixes. And I realized that. And so I held on to it and didn't use it in the second book because I wanted to save it for the third book. And then definitely we were like, let's go with a blue because of so much of it took place in New Attica. And I wanted New Attica to feel, you know, very Brave New World, very like a city that looks like it was made by, you know, Apple.
Yeah.
So you kind of like, I want that antiseptic kind of feel to run through the whole book. That blue was the bane of my existence, though. It was such a tough color to work with. You think it wouldn't be, but... we had a real hard time because it is tonally can be so close to the grays. It just doesn't feel as colorful,
right.
You know? So I was glad to get back to a color that is much more richer, like the green in the first book. There's a couple like sunsets because the sun's kind of setting on our hero. You know, this is the end of it. So it worked out in a serendipitous sort of way.
Yeah. It's really gorgeous. I mean, and I see what you mean where, you know, with the more black or gray, you know, it does have that really rich red look to it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, yeah. But it's also, it works for like the paler skin tones and the
yeah.
smoke. Yeah.
And in fact, the first print run, the inks are a little dark. So I've been told that on the second printing, they're going to dial them back a little bit. So it's a little heavier on the first printing. And it happens. It happened on the last book too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that color can be such an integral part to setting the emotional mood and tone of the entire book. It's an important decision to make.
Is there any plans for any augmented reality on this one? Or I noticed the little Omnipod icons, but there wasn't any mention of it. So I said, well, maybe they're
we're done. Yeah. No, I think we questioned whether to do it. I mean, it was amazing to do it on the first one, and it wasn't ever part of the plan at all when we worked on Wandla. The folks who designed the augmented reality had come to Simon & Schuster and shown them the technology, and the folks at Simon & Schuster were, you know, understandably blown away by it, and they were kind of waiting for the right book. And I remember very well, you know, my editor calling me and saying, you know, we have this technology and we think you're, you know, we've been waiting for the right project and we think your book is it. And I was really torn, to be honest with you, because I was like, I don't know. It feels a little gimmicky, and I've worked so hard on this book, and I don't know if it needs that. And he said, well, you know, think on it overnight. And I went to bed going, what would Lewis Carroll do, or what would L. Frank Baum do? And I thought they would go for it. They would think this is really cool. In my mind, they would. So I went for it, and I no regrets on it. I loved it. It was amazing. Our browsers are I don't know about you, I'm on Safari and Firefox, and so they're constantly requiring updates, and so the software to run it becomes obsolete fairly quick. We talked about it pretty heavily in the second book, whether we should do it or not, and they made a good case, and they showed us some pretty neat stuff, and I liked the idea of playing almost like a video game with the book, but by the time it came to the third one, I felt like it didn't need it anymore. We've kind of grown past it. And in fact, I don't even think it works on the other books anymore. I think moving forward, like the subsequent printings of book one and two won't have the AR element any longer. But I loved those flourishes, so we put them in. So hopefully no one will be too baffled. The 20 people that got it to actually work on their computer, hopefully they won't be too disappointed.
I know, in addition to Wandla, you're also working on Star Wars.
That's right.
You know, you just need to take over another universe.
I know, my geek credits. It's going up, man. I wish you had like the IMDb has like their like star meter. I need like
you need a star meter.
I might have a little like a blip on it now.
So how'd you get involved with the Star Wars? Well, actually, for people who don't know, there's some novelizations. It's the first three movies plus yours, right?
Lucasfilm now working with Disney, and Disney's publishing division is in Disney. That would be Disney Press is going to start its own imprint, basically Star Wars themed books. And I had the unbelievable honor to be the first book on the list.
No pressure.
The folks at Lucasfilm knew I was a huge Star Wars fan and have been, you know, since I saw the films originally. And Carol Roeder, who's the head of the licensing, actually came from Simon & Schuster, which is where I've published almost all of my books. So she and I have known each other for a long time. I think she was waiting for just the right project for me, because I would dance around some projects, but then I was just so darn busy. It was hard for me to really commit the time. So she called me last fall and said, you know, we would like to take Ralph McQuarrie's art and make a book out of Ralph's art. And Ralph, if you don't know, was the first concept artist to work with George Lucas. He painted paintings of iconic scenes for the first film that, as far as I understand it, helped George actually even get the funding to make the first film. And he also designed a lot of, if you're a Star Wars geek like me, a lot of our favorite characters, so like C-3PO, R2-D2, Darth Vader. He designed the Death Star. I mean, a lot of major components of Star Chewbacca.
Yeah.
He designed. You know, I have the art of books. I have the ones I've had since I was a kid. So I was familiar with his work. But if you asked me to, you know, I probably knew about maybe 10 to 20 images. So I thought, you know, well, yeah, maybe there's something there. And then they're like, okay, well, we'll send you over a PDF of his art. And like 200 plus show up. And I'm like, holy cow, I had no idea. And I mean, tons of paintings, tons of sketches, a lot of stuff that I had never seen before that was really, really cool. So the trick was they wanted it to be like a picture book. And so they kind of were like, can you write this and assemble this and make it into a picture book? And so I was like, all right, I'll, I think I can do this, and I want to do this. So I kind of laid out, I printed out all of Ralph's art. Obviously, I knew the story. So that,
yeah.
My daughter knows the story. She can tell you the story. So the trick now was, how do I still present it in a book format and in a narrative form using, you know, my philosophical approach of how a picture book should read and be paced and et cetera. But you're not creating the artwork, nor can you get the artist to create any new art. So you're only bound by, you know, the art that you have. In some ways, it answered a lot of questions because I was able to see right away where the art could do a lot of the storytelling and then where the text was going to have to do a lot of heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, Ralph painted a lot of amazing images, but he never painted, you know, Obi-Wan and Darth Vader fighting with their lightsabers.
Okay.
He never painted the destruction of really both Death Stars. There's an explosion on one of the Death Stars, but there was no painting of the Death Star blowing up, yeah. Right? So big moments were missing. And a lot of his paintings also were very scenic. They were like vistas, mm-hmm. Like this is what Cloud City looks like. And you'd have figures, but they were not always the predominant element in his paintings. There's some that were, but there were a lot that weren't. So that was also a challenge to try to feel. I felt like for me, a picture book is so much about the human element. We have to project ourselves into the character, whether it's, you know, Max going to where the wild things are, or the Onceler talking to the Lorax. You know, it's very care. I'm a very character driven person. The books I like tend to be character driven. So, based on compressing the stories down to such a short length, we knew right away that it would have to focus just on Luke Skywalker. And unfortunately, things like bounty hunters and as much as there were so many cool paintings of like Boba Fett and the other bounty hunters, there was no room for them, you know. And so we kept it focused on Luke, and it actually also answered a lot of questions and helped it moving. So in the end, I tried to mix as much of Ralph's iconic paintings that if you're a Star Wars geek, you know and you've seen, along with some lesser known and lesser seen images that he did. And in fact, in the scene where Luke goes back to Dagobah and he's talking to Yoda and then later to Obi-Wan about, Yoda confirms that Darth Vader is his father. Mm-hmm. And then through his conversation with Obi-Wan, he realizes that Leia is his sister. There's a cover that Ralph did for the first kind of spinoff book called A Splinter in the Mind's Eye. And it has on this cover, it came out in like, I think the late 70s or the early 80s. It has on the cover Darth Vader, and it looks like he's on Dagobah because he's in a forested area. And then he's facing you, and then there's Luke and Leia looking at him. I'm like, oh, there's the illustration. So they had the art. So they were totally like, yeah, you can use this. So I was super psyched to be able to kind of tie that in. So if you're like an old diehard fan of Star Wars stuff, you're going to see some of these amazing pieces of art that Ralph did that maybe not everyone has seen.
So how long is this book then?
It's 64 pages. Mm. And so the trick then is, I don't know about you guys in your reading, we're not storybook can be a bad word in publishing because it's kind of fish nor fowl. It's not a picture book, right? Because it's longer, it's denser, but then it's not really a chapter book either because it's presented in a picture book format. It's got a lot of art that can be viewed as juvenile. Though I love a picture book, they are hard books to do. So though it's 64 pages, we really adhered to a picture book kind of word count and length. So there are passages that are a little longer than I would have liked, but for the most part, it's like two paragraphs, three paragraphs on a page, and that's it. And it keeps moving. And so the story is obviously truncated, but I wanted to give all the real estate to Ralph and his amazing art that he did, you know?
There needs to be a new word then for like these bigger picture books. So I feel like I'm seeing more of them.
I think that it's just silly categorization, and it happens, and we do that. Someone will break it and blow it out huge, and then there'll be 5 million of them. It happens with Pop. Robert Sabuda did it with pop-up books. The folks that did Dragonology did it with the interactive Lift the Flat books. Mm-hmm. someone will do it, and then all of a sudden it'll be the new thing. Maybe I'm doing the wrong. maybe I should get back to Wanla, that big guide, and just big storybook.
The junior novelization of the movie.
Yes. So I'm doing this kind of picture book, and then they tapped, you know, these beloved middle grade authors to write middle grade adaptations of the original three films. Raquel Palacio, who did Wonder, which is a great, amazing story, and the main character is a Star Wars fan in that book. She's doing A New Hope. Adam Gidwitz, who did Tail, Dark, and Grim, which I love, love, love those books. He's doing Empire Strikes Back. And then Tom Engelberger, who many Star Wars fans know, is the author of the Origami Yoda books. He's doing Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, very cool. And I guess this will be coming out in the next few years or so.
Yeah, my book, The Adventures of Luke Skywalker, is out in October. And theirs, I'm going to guess, starts like early next year. And they probably are like boom, boom, boom throughout the year. I think they're all out by the time the new film comes out. That would be my guess.
Which would be like December 2015.
Yeah, not that we're like...
Not at all. Yeah, I heard they just announced the cast.
I heard that
I haven't
today.
Gotten to see it yet. I haven't gotten to go read that yet, but that's what I heard. So we'll see.
Yes. Yeah, I'm excited that in some ways I'm very excited to see that the original cast is going to be in it. It's to what extent are they in it, and... You know, to what extent are the new characters given their chance to do their thing? That's the trick.
Yeah. It's like you put the old guard in because that's going to call out to the older audience, but the newer audience isn't going to care quite as much.
Yeah. No, actually, most children today, because I talk about Star Wars a lot when I do my book presentations in schools and in bookstores, and when I ask children and kids what their favorite Star Wars film is or character. It's not the original trilogy. It's the prequels that came out afterwards. That's what most of the kids like. Sorry, I know that's like blasphemy.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you know, I think that all the parents hope that, you know, the kids love Empire Strikes Back the most because that's the best one, you know. But it's, you know, they like the pod racing, right? And Jar Jar. They just think he's hilarious. You're like, no.
Exactly. Yes. You've hit the nail right on the head. That's it. Or the bounty hunter right on the head. The Gungan.
Hit the Gungan on the head.
Hit the Gungan right on the head.
It's been fantastic talking to you.
As always, man. It's been great.
Good luck with your book tour, and I hope Battle for Wanla does really well.
Thank you. Excited to read it. I'm excited to share it finally. And even like the artwork, I've been very like tight-lipped. I would say this. I mean... You almost don't want to flip through the book and look at the art because it was hard to not put spoilers in the art. And even then, the artwork appears sometimes several chapters after the spoiler is revealed. And even then, there were scenes I just didn't draw because I was worried that it would just give too much away if someone casually flipped through the book. So that's why I've been really like not sharing. I'm going to start putting some art up here leading up to the release of it, but... I've been really careful about not putting a whole lot of art because I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah, and I'm a no spoilers sort of guy, but I was like, oh, but I have to at least look at it a little bit. I hope I don't see anything I don't want to know yet.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, I mean, I tried to be thoughtful about it. So when you see it, if you happen to flip through it, you think you know what it is, and then hopefully you realize, oh, it's not exactly what I thought it was. So that's the idea, at least. We'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, good talking to you. And,
as always, thanks so much.
You know, I'll have to find some other excuse to talk to you again soon. Now that the Wanla series is done,
let's do it again in October.
All right. Sounds good.
Yep. Oh.